Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 4 years ago this month, floods engulfed much of the state of Iowa around its rivers, forcing thousands from their homes and causing billions of dollars in damages. Cedar Rapids and now Iowa City were hardest hit. And while most of us were reading about the disaster, people lived on there with the rising waters. They just had to go on living whatever arc of their lives they were in at that point, as did Joe Blair, heating and air conditioning repairman with a wife and four children. Also a writer, Joe Blair has written a memoir from that time. It is about his relationships with his wife and family, infidelity, fantasies, and apparently lost dreams. And throughout most of the story is the flooding. Joe Blair joins us now to talk about his memoir, By the Iowa Sea and the Times of the Floods. He's a graduate of the University of Massachusetts Lowell and the University of Iowa Nonfiction Writing Program. His essays have been published in the New York Times, Salon.com, The Iowa Review, and the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
First of all, are you still repairing air conditioners?
Yeah, I just want to correct that. I'm a writer and also an air conditioning mechanic, okay? No. If we broke it down by the hour, I'd be very much an air conditioning repairman first.
Okay.
Probably 10 hours a day. And if I'm lucky, you know, I can get in an hour a day of writing.
Which is how you produce the book.
That's right. Yeah. it was kind of a trick. A friend of mine taught me. She calls it fast writing. When I can, I used to have to have my writing partner with me.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd sit across the table from one another and open our laptops and go. And you just go. I mean, you can do 2,000 words in an hour pretty easily if you don't really stop and ponder everything all the time. So we just went. And then when we're done writing, we just read whatever it is we've written to one another. And that's how we did it. And you can get a lot done that way in an hour of writing every day. And now I don't really need my writing partner. I love my writing partner, but I don't need her anymore to be across the table from me that I can actually do it. And that part of the writing process where you read aloud to the other person what it is you've written is so important. But now I can kind of read it to myself. It's kind of like a way of knowing when what you've written is no good.
By reading it aloud?
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right. Because as you say the words, when they don't feel right coming out of your mouth, and you feel kind of embarrassed saying them, and or you know it's not good, it's not your voice, it's not true, so you know what to edit. And I've kind of learned to know that, and that's what takes the longest for me, because when I finish writing something, my first instinct is to think it's great. This is the best thing I've ever written. This is great, you know. This is awesome. And then the editing side of my mind takes over, and I say, no, it's not awesome. This paragraph I like. This paragraph works. This part goes out, and then I can do that myself now. But it took a while.
I remember in a poetry writing class in college, if the instructor kept one line of a poem of any one of us, you felt like you were doing good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know what? It's amazing how differently different writers go about it. I have a friend, Joanne Beard, who's written a couple of books, Boys of My Youth, and In Zanesville recently came out. She is a very slow writer. She's just self-editing the entire time. She has a hard time. But, man, can she write beautifully. And that's just the way she does it. Everybody mm-hmm. does it differently. I guess I had to do it this way because it was my only option. If I wrote one sentence every hour, you know, I guess I'd be a haiku writer. try to get one of those published.
Right. My guest is Joe Blair, author of By the Iowa Sea. It's a memoir of disaster and love. It takes place during the 2008 flood in Iowa. I guess it crested on the Cedar River four years ago yesterday,
right.
At 10
That's
feet
right.
over flood stage. That's
yep.
huge.
I know. Yesterday, I was on a service call up in Cedar Rapids, and Mr. Rainbolt, who's in charge of this building, United Fire and Casualty. I was working in the basement where their chiller is, and I'm like looking around. I'm like, well, it's, you know, it's not a new building, but everything in this room is brand new. I'm like, what the heck? He's like, yeah, floods. I'm like, oh, of course. And he said, the water, I think, in that section was 7 feet deep. In that section of Cedar Rapids. And there's another section. So they had to replace, of course, their chiller, their all their electrical, everything
right
down there. There's another section of town that was kind of a cool little section of town that went 15 feet under in Cedar Rapids. Imagine that. It's just hard to imagine.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's very hard.
The street, you look up 15 feet, you can still see the water marks in some parts of it. It's Czech Village, it's called. Like things were just completely underwater. It's hard to fathom. No pun intended.
You used an image, I think, pretty early in the story about a pine tree in the front yard that waved in the wind as if it was underwater.
Yeah.
And I thought, did he write this before or after the flood?
No, that was a mistake. That was just, it just happened. That's what I thought it looked like. It was
yeah.
Total chance. It's like most of the stuff in the book. It's like after you write it, you just write it, and then you go back and look like, wow, that really works. Wow, people will think I
yeah.
really know what I'm doing. But, no, when you have that 100-year-old glass in a window
yeah.
and sort of things move outside the window,
yeah.
it doesn't. It's not smooth. It's sort of like rippled. That's just what I was describing, but I didn't do it on purpose. It was innocent.
Your story largely takes place during the Iowa floods in 2008, and I was wondering, to what extent as a writer were the floods as a backdrop? You said that the floods weren't just a metaphor.
Which is ironic. I mean, to use the flood as a metaphor in your book and then to say the flood's not a metaphor, I mean, that no one will believe a word I say, but it's true. I mean, what's the difference between a thing itself and what we use it for, or what it becomes to us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it becomes to us something over time or through examination, whether we paint it, write about it, write a song about it, whatever it is, it needs to become something else to us. But a flood itself, I mean, the more I think about the book, you know, when I finished with the book, people ask me what it's about. I'm like, I don't know what the hell it's about. I just wrote it. I just wrote a book, and you tell me what it's about. But, of course, after living with it for 4 years and thinking about it, the book's about change. In other words, it's about freedom. Because what is freedom if not choice? And if you make a choice, you can change your life dramatically. And when the flood comes, things change. It's not like with no choice. Things change. And we live these lives and have these jobs and are married to these people and are in these circumstances. And sometimes we think this will never change. This is the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
And some people are in agony and misery and Maybe some people haven't accepted their circumstances and think, my God, you know, I can't do it anymore. This is the way life is, and it'll never change. And here comes something, a flood in this case. And you can't go to work anymore. You can't take these roads anymore. You can't go home anymore. Everything changes. People who had their house paid for that were out of the 5-year flood plain. Out of the 500-year floodplain, no insurance, their house got flooded, and they lost everything. You know, there was one retired guy in Cedar Rapids in that circumstance, and he found himself homeless. And I know about him because he came into the hospital where my wife was working, that he had a stroke. He stroked out on the sidewalk, and the cops came and thought he was a drunk, and they moved him aside, and somehow this guy makes it all the way to the hospital by himself. And he's dressed in these filthy coveralls, and when they cut the coveralls off, they find that he's dressed in a navy blue suit with a tie so that he can go to job interviews, because he was retired. He owned his own home. But now here he is on the street. You know, it's heartbreaking. Things change, mm-hmm. You know.
And the irony, of course, is that you're yearning for change. You're yearning for the days back when, in the olden days, when you and your wife were going to travel the world.
Right.
And then you find yourself with four children, one of whom is autistic, living in Iowa, you know, fixing air conditioners.
Uh-huh.
So I just thought the change that occurred over that span of the story was amazing. Mm. And then I went back and thought, oh, that's right. He was looking for that change.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and I think, you know, we go through our lives and there are moments when we stop and we say, wait a minute. Where am I? Who am I? What am I doing? How did all this happen to me? And that's a place that I came to in the flood, and I think a lot of people came to that place in the flood, because it makes you check yourself, you know?
You know, the flood sort of creeps up on you as a reader. You write about the rain and the clouds at the beginning, and then the detours with the bridges being out, and then the next thing you know, you're standing hip-deep in polluted river water, lugging 40-pound sandbags with a bunch of other volunteers. Mm-hmm. Is that what it felt like being there? It kind of was a creeper sort of thing? Versus, say, that tumultuous day when Katrina hit, well, not when Katrina hit, but when, yeah, I mean, when the flooding started there in New Orleans, it felt a little different.
You know, I know this is, we're not supposed to say this. No one's supposed to say this, but I was ebullient when the river flooded. Because I know that people were homeless. I know that all this meant horrible things for a lot of people. But to sandbag with a group of people, you feel like a superhero. You know, you feel like you're doing something, like we're going to save this neighborhood. And we were all sure of it. We didn't save the neighborhood, mm-hmm. but we thought we were going to. You know, we were working together. And here comes this flood. Here comes this amazing thing. And it won. It took over. My son and I were paddling around in our old neighborhood. They call it Mosquito Flats. And to see just roofs of houses sticking out of the water, to like paddle over fences, over stop signs, and look down and see them, and to see things that way, it was beautiful. It was beautiful, and in sort of a nihilistic way, you know. You shouldn't say it's beautiful. It's a tragedy. It's horrible, but it, in a way, it was a miracle for me and my family.
You wrote several times, at least at the beginning, you referred to your wife Deb's love of rain. You said one time that you don't know if it's a love of rain or the love of being protected from rain or the storms. I thought that was kind of interesting way to put it.
Yeah. Isn't it sometimes, you know, these routines that we get into? Well, I stop for coffee at Starbucks at 6:30 every morning, and I listen to Mike and Mike in the morning on the radio, and I do this and I do that, and you're like, oh my God, this is horrible. I keep doing the same thing over and over, and then you divert from that routine, like maybe wildly, and then, oh my God, I can't wait to get back. You know, so it's like if there's a fear, there's a we love routine and we hate it. You know, at least I do. In my mind, I'm this crazy, wild person, but come on, you know, I my life is, what's more routine than an air conditioning repairman living in Iowa, for Christ's sake, you know? It's totally routine, but in my mind, at least now, after the flood, I have made choices, but the choices I have made were to stay with my wife and to love her and to stay with my family and to love them. And to, you know what? I love my job. I didn't even know it until the flood hit. But I do. I love my job. I love to do it. I love to listen to sports talk. I love coffee. So, you know, what the hell? Yeah, it's a routine, but it's a routine I have chosen now, you know, and that makes all the difference.
My guest is Joe Blair. He's author of By the Iowa Sea, a memoir of disaster and love. It takes place during the 2008 floods in Iowa. 4 years ago yesterday, the Cedar River, crested at 10 yeah. feet above stage level. I mean, above flood level. So the flood stage, I should say. So it was pretty traumatic. And we're going to return to our conversation right after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Home Care Assistance, in-home care for older adults with a philosophy of promoting health, well-being, and quality of life for all clients, no matter their limitations. Information on Home Care Assistance at 481-8888.
WOSU Public Media presents the Chefs in the City online auction. You can bid now on fabulous culinary-themed packages, but hurry, today is the very last day of the auction. All proceeds benefit children's educational programming on WOSU, so check in, bid high to buy, visit wosu.org/chefs to see all the items that are up for bid. Weather forecast, short and sweet, sunny and warm. A high today of 84 with sunshine, low tonight 62 and clear skies. Tomorrow, sunshine and 86, more clear skies tomorrow night, and then by Saturday, sunny skies once again and a high of 88 degrees. Right now, under sunny skies in central Ohio, we have a rather toasty 73 degrees at our studios.
My guest is Joe Blair, author of By the Iowa Sea, a memoir of disaster and love. If you have a question or comment for Joe, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Joe, I wanted to talk about your job a little bit more, your day job, I guess, the 10-hour day job. It was, you make an interesting, well, you mentioned Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance at the beginning of the story, that was something I think your dad gave you to read, or
yeah.
Anyways, you read it, and it was
yeah.
a really big deal. I don't know how, you were pretty young when you read it. I think I read it in college, but I really noticed something of an influence, in my opinion, on your writing and that how you describe your job, because I loved that book. And I still don't understand what I was reading about, but I loved reading about how he fixed the motorcycle and how he maintained the motorcycle. Likewise, your heating and cooling job. Just it's really interesting how you break it down and take somebody through the process.
I think Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Persig, he talks yeah. about like there being two types of people. There's the type of people who just want to ride the bike, and there's the kind of people who want to fix the bike. But in a way, like he himself was both kind of people, and I myself am both kind of people, because I fix things, which is very linear. You need logic. You need to deduce what the problem is, and then you need to fix it. Mm-hmm. And there is a certain amount of theory, but it's a different type of thinking from writing. Writing is going about things in a completely different way. And like if I'm working on a piece of equipment and I just say, I just feel like this piece of equipment, needs a hug.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be employed very long. I have a sense that this piece of equipment is almost like a flood in a way. You'd be like, get the hell out of here, and get someone in here who can fix the air conditioner.
Mm-hmm.
But I think my writing very much is informed by what I do with my hands. I think the hands inform the head just as much as the head informs the hands. And I am very split. I'm a split person, so that but they do come together in my writing. Maybe that's where the connection came, was in The Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
You compare floods with tornadoes and fires in
yeah.
the book.
Mm-hmm.
Floods, how are floods different? What's the difference?
Well, because when a flood recedes, when the waters recede, and there it is. Look, hey, there's the neighborhood where we owned a house for 7.5 years that used to be underwater, and now it's not. Boy, the neighborhood's still here. Oh, look, there's Czech Village, which was like 13, 14, 15 feet underwater. Oh, well, it was just water. Now the water's gone. And you don't really realize the devastation of a flood until you spend some time. You go into the structures, you see what happened. If there's a fire, the building's gone. A fire, it destroyed the building. It took it away. A tornado, it destroys things. But in floods, destroy things in a different way. But sort of what I was trying to get at, I think, intentionally making a metaphor here, I was not innocent of this one, your life being the same before and after an event like this in all appearances, but different, that the old life is gone. You know, when you go in to a building that's been flooded and you see this thick layer of silt that's on it with all the pollution that was in that river, all those nitrates that were in the field, and pesticides, and now you just touch it and it's airborne, you breathe it in. This building is destroyed. This building will no longer be what it was. So, and it needs to be renovated. It needs to be new. You need to make a choice about what you're going to do here. You know, from here on in, life is going to be different. And it was for my family and myself.
It was
for a lot of people.
Yeah, it was a little different. In the Katrina case, there were entire neighborhoods, and really, mm-hmm. you know, Paris is swept away in the flood because of the hydraulic force of it was different.
Yeah, we had a mini flood.
Well,
really.
It was like I said, it was a creeper,
mm-hmm.
just little by little by little.
Yeah, and it was funny. You know, I was talking to the guy, Rainbolt, at the job yesterday at United Fire.
I love that name, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's awesome. But he's like, we were all standing outside, and the water was sort of coming up, and we're like, it's not going to get here. And it sort of come up a little more, no way it's going to get here. And they were like 2 blocks from the river. I mean, they were right there. And then they said, well, we got a generator, and we left it up on the first floor. And it flooded. It was underwater. They lost their generator. They had some boots, and they set them way up high. Well, the boots went under. And the same thing happened down at Hoosier Supply, which is like, 10 blocks up away from the river. They were watching the water come up, and they're like, there's no way. There's no way. I mean, they're 10 blocks away.
Mm-hmm.
But this flood, it flooded 1,000 city blocks in Cedar Rapids. It's astounding. It's like it took over. But, yeah, it was a creeper. No one believed it. No one believed it. That will never happen. It has never happened. It won't happen. But it happened.
My guest is Joe Blair, author of By the Iowa Sea, a memoir of disaster and love. It's been 4 years now since the floods in Iowa devastated, as he just said, 1,000
mm-hmm.
square blocks, 1,000 blocks of Cedar Rapids, and Iowa City was hard hit as well. You make an interesting point that news reports refer to the people who have lost everything in the floods as victims, as if there was a perpetrator. And that as if you could go out and arrest somebody and blame them and make them pay.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of reminded me of like when a shark takes someone's leg or kills someone. They hunt the shark down and kill it.
As if.
Like, oh, what a bad shark. That shark should know better. Shark doesn't know better. River doesn't know a damn thing. You know, it's following the rules that rivers follow. Like when there's a lot of water, overflow the banks. How about that for a rule? You know, it's life. You know, life has changed. And, you know, the minute you lose your first relative or loved one, you know that. I mean, that's what happens. Things change. That's what this flood reminded me of, you know.
Your son Michael has autism. That is a significant thread in the book. And, of course, and it's something else like the floods that you can't change.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something you kind of resolved. There was a feeling like, I guess your wife, Deb, used to say maybe if you did this or maybe if you did that, you could change it.
Well, yeah, you know, it was, and, you know, we still believe that. We have to believe it. You know, we have to believe we can fix him. You know, if he was a piece of equipment, we'd try to fix him. But But also, you know, there's that opening in the back of your mind and sometimes in the forefront of your mind that we can't do it, that he cannot be fixed, that whatever we have tried, and believe me, we've tried a lot of things, it doesn't work. So what choice are you going to make now? You know, are you going to say, well, he's broken, so to hell with him? No, you don't. You say, we have chosen to believe he can get better. We've chosen to do everything we can and never stop doing everything we can. But we've also chosen to love him, of course, regardless of what happens. You know, we're not trying to fix him for us so he can't talk to us, you know, mm-hmm. or so he can go out and get a job and leave us alone. We're trying to fix him because autism is excruciating for him.
It hurts.
To have these things, like electrical, they're not like electrical impulses. Electrical impulses jumping around in your brain all the time, and words repeating themselves, and it makes them squeal and scream and wiggle strings and walk back and forth and pull down his pants and do horrible things in public, but he can't help it. You know, he can't help it. Imagine, you know, and he's there. He's right there. He understands everything we say. He's right there, but he can't get through. It's excruciating for him. So, of course, it's excruciating for us too. But you know, there's a big element of acceptance, and sometimes we have to get beaten down to earth with a big hammer, you know, to believe that, oh, there are things in this world we can't change. There are things in this world we need to accept. As a matter of fact, the things we can change are like 1/100th of 100th percent. We can change a little, but most things in the world we need to accept, you know.
And then on the other side of that coin, you can't stop change.
That's right. And well, that's part of acceptance, right?
Right.
You know, the world comes at us. And you know, I know it's sometimes in our society, we're go-getters, we work a lot of hours, and we have a lot of belief in ourselves. But sometimes even the wisest prophets are small, you know. We're just people are just people, and we do what we can.
You're I've written many memoirs. I'm sure a lot of the people who are listening right now have read many memoirs before. Yours is you pretty much lay it all out there. Maybe you hold something back. I don't know what it is. I don't know if I want to know what it is, but
if only I could tell you.
Shut up.
I know.
Well, I guess, you know, I love your wife. Don't know her, but
me too,
I love her.
Me too.
And how did your family, and I think I read something on Facebook from one of your nephews or nieces saying, hey, Uncle Joe just wrote a book and you got to read it. It's great. It's like, oh,
no
my gosh,
kidding.
Your nieces and
no
nephews
kidding.
Are reading this? This
think
is,
about it.
This is,
think about being exposed. Jeez.
Yeah. Your wife, your
because
children,
for those of
everything.
You don't know, there was I had an affair on my wife during this flood. It was part of this rising water, new life, changing things thing going on. And yeah, we went through a lot of embarrassing things that probably if I were to sit down and talk to someone across the table during dinner, I'd never, ever, ever say it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're writing, you're all alone. You're all alone. I'm just writing it. But and to lie when you're all by yourself writing, it is insane. I mean, you need to tell the truth, and you need to in order to get somewhere with your writing. You want to find something. You want to move somewhere with your writing, and so it's easy. You just do it. But of course, the moment comes when someone likes it. Oh, an agent liked my book. Oh, well, it's still never get published. Oh, an editor likes my book. Well, they'll never buy it. Well, an editor bought my book. Uh-oh. You know, hey, editor, hey, can I take all this stuff out? No, that's why we bought it. You know, that's what we like about it. So, yeah, before it was published, I had some serious second, third, fourth thoughts about letting this stuff out there. But I think ultimately I did it because I think it's the right thing to do, because I think there are a lot of people like myself that are have come to places in their marriages of despair and have lost hope and have special needs children and are just beaten down to the ground with it, and it's such a heavy weight. And at least, and at the very least, you know, to know that there's someone else out there that's going through the same thing, I think it was the right thing to do. And as far as my nephews and my boys will never read the book because they...
Yeah, mine never listens to the show.
Well, they're never going to read the book because they're like, hey, Dad, can we read the book? I'm like, yeah, you can read it if you want to, but I don't think you want to. Well, why not? Do you guys want to read about your mother and me having sex? And the boys are like, no, not at all. So that was a cure-all. But my daughter, on the other hand, I think she's probably already read it. So she doesn't seem to be ruined by it. I wish she wouldn't have read it, but, you know, hey, you take the good with the bad. I guess you just, it's hard to put yourself out there like that. But by the same token, I think sometimes the right thing to do is hard. And I think it was the right thing to do. I hope I'm right. I might be wrong.
Email from Sarah. She writes, please tell Mr. Blair that his voice sounds like Alan Alda and that his sense of humor is very similar as well. I don't know Alan Alda, but...
Awesome.
I guess I kind of get the sound reference. We're running out of time here, but I read this in Wikipedia about the Iowa flooding of 2008. And it made me think of your book, The Flooding of Cedar Rapids and Iowa City were the most significant events. Recovery in particular for Cedar Rapids is considered to be a protracted and costly affair. For Iowa City, the level of damage was less than expected. And that kind of reminded me of you. Ultimately, things work out. And I was wondering, in your opinion, if Iowa is better for the floods or worse?
Well, it's impossible for me to say, and it's kind of like talking about statistics before you have a child. Like, there's 1 in 10,000% chance that 1 in 10,000 children will be born with this thing. Well, it's probably not going to happen. Well, these statistics don't matter when you have the kid and the kid has it. You know what I mean? The statistic, there are no statistics. If they're 100%, he has it. So if you're one person and you just lost your house, you know, it's better than you thought for Iowa? Oh, great. I just lost my house. So better or worse, hard to say. I mean, it's not better for the person who lost their house and who died in the hospital of a stroke, homeless, you know, but I hate to say it, better for me. That sounds horrible, but it's the truth. I mean, it changed us. It changed us for the better. It changed a lot of people for the worse, their circumstances, I'm sure.
Well, Joe Blair, thanks for sharing your story. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Joe Blair is the author of By the Iowa Sea, a memoir of disaster and love. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation about the Iowa floods with the mayor of Cedar Rapids, Ron Corbett, and also a reporter from the Cedar Rapids Gazette. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, a far-right Christian radio talk show host who is trying to influence the Republican Party. We talk with New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer about her new article profiling Brian Fisher, the talk show host whose anti-gay comments led to the resignation of Mitt Romney's foreign policy spokesperson, Richard Grenell, who is gay. Join us.
Fresh Air comes your way in about 20 minutes here at 12 noon on 89.7 NPR News. In the weather forecast, sunny skies for today with a high of about 84 degrees. Tonight, clear skies and an overnight low of 62. Then on Friday, a high of 86 degrees and a low of 63 Friday night. Again, sunny skies tomorrow and clear skies tomorrow night. On Saturday, lots of sunshine and a high of 88. We are now up to 75 degrees at our studios here on the Ohio State University campus.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
Many 89.7 NPR News members have discovered the advantages of using the WOSU member card. It's good for two-for-one dining, cultural events, and family activities, and the member card benefit of the month for June is the Wexner Center for the Arts. Enjoy two-for-one admission to the galleries, subject to availability. Thank you very much for supporting 89.7 NPR News.
This month marks the four-year anniversary of the Iowa floods of 2008. In fact, it was 4 years ago yesterday that the Cedar River in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, reached its crest. That overall disaster forced thousands of Iowans from their homes and caused billions of dollars in damage. The 2008 floods and later tornadoes in Iowa are considered to be the sixth largest FEMA disaster based on estimated financial assistance. Joining us now to talk about that is Rick Smith. He's a reporter for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Hi, Ann.
And also with us, Ron Corbett. He's mayor of Cedar Rapids. Thanks for joining us, Mayor Corbett.
Thank you, and good morning to everyone.
Hi, Mayor.
Some 18,000 people lived in Cedar Rapids at the time. 10,000 of them were displaced during the disaster. I wondered, Mayor Corbett, if you could just give us a little bit of a rundown of what Cedar Rapids looks like today in terms of population and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, actually, that was one of the concerns of the community. Oftentimes after a disaster, you know, people leave and relocate to either a different state or somewhere else within a state. Cedar Rapids didn't have that. The census data came out in 2010, and the flood happened in 2008, and we grew by 4.3%. So not only did we not lose the population, but we actually gained in population. So that I think that's a really strong sign of our recovery from that disaster.
Rick Smith, you've been working at the Gazette for something like three decades now.
Right.
Had you ever seen anything like this before in three decades?
No, nothing at all like this, Ann. We've had, I think in 93 and 98 in particular, I think the river challenged the city a little bit, but nothing sort of like this. Ann, did you say just a second ago that Cedar Rapids had 18,000 people?
That's what I read.
I mean, I hate to sound defensive here, but...
Well, no, some 18,000 people lived in the flood-impacted area.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah.
It's 125,000.
Gotcha. Yes.
We're more important than 18,000.
Let's set that straight right
okay,
now.
Good.
And 125,000. Actually, I learned a lot about Cedar Rapids in preparing for this, a lot more than I did from the movie.
It was a funny movie, though.
It was a funny movie. So recovery continues. Let's just go a little step further. Cedar Rapids is the second largest city in Iowa. It's the county seat of Linn County. It lies on both banks of the Cedar River. It's 20 miles north of Iowa City and 100 miles east of the state capital of Des Moines. Mayor Corbett, I was just talking with Joe Blair, the author, about Iowa and whether it's better off or not. And he said in some ways it is. And of course, for a lot of people, it's not. How do you measure recovery from something this gigantic and drastic?
Well, there's a lot of different variables that you can measure at that. I think the one issue that I pointed out earlier is our population did not decrease. Mm-hmm. We also beat the national statistics as it relates to job losses. I mean, many businesses, whatever the disaster is, whether it's a hurricane or flood, tornadoes never come back. And we had some special programs that were actually first-time programs that we worked with HUD and the Community Development Block Grant process to really help us do some case management for our local businesses. And I think that has allowed us to maintain our job level. Cedar Rapids' unemployment rate today, Ann, is 5.2%, which is 3 percentage points below the national average. And then the neighborhoods, you actually have to look into the neighborhoods that were flooded. And certainly we have had some challenges as we've had to demolish homes and then repopulate the neighborhoods with new homes, and that transition takes some time. But you know, we're well on our way to full recovery, thanks to a combination of issues, the state government, the federal government, local government stepping up, the private sector, and really the people of Cedar Rapids. This became a unifying event for our community.
I think one thing I want your listeners to understand is that I don't know if the timing of this disaster was just right or not, but it happened in 2008, 2009. Congress and the federal government really started paying attention to the city in a funding way. And there are more. The federal government could hardly have been more generous to the city of Cedar Rapids in this disaster. Federal funding, with the help of some state funding, has bought out 1,200 properties, demolished most of them, provided nice funding to help replace them. Most of the city's public buildings were in the downtown. Most of them were damaged by the flood. There's great federal support and state support to rebuild them. And right now, here at the four-year mark, we're seeing what I was talking to the city manager this week, and he calls it kind of a rebirth of the city, a renaissance of the city. And we've got construction going on in the downtown now for a library, convention center, arena, City Hall, Riverfront.
You just opened up the City Hall, the new City Hall, right?
We did. Central Fire Station, Riverfront Amphitheater, a brand new federal courthouse, things that it might have taken 20 years for the city to have seen happen, and they're happening right now. I don't want to say that the flood had a silver lining, but the federal government and Iowa's senators and congressional staff really came to bat for Cedar Rapids and for Iowa. And that's really really a big part of the Cedar Rapids story, I think.
Mayor Corbett, you have an office, finally. You took office in 2009, I should say, but you actually have a real office with, I guess, a desk and a chair and that sort of thing?
Yes, and I'm sitting at that desk and sitting in that chair for like the second time since moving here. No, we've had temporary locations, just like a lot of citizens have had temporary locations until they could either get back into their homes or get new homes built. But City Hall did move back into the old federal courthouse that federal government, after the flood, decided to build a new building, and that will be dedicated later this year. And they gave us the old building, and so for cost reasons and for historic preservation, and the city government moved in, and we moved in last week. So we're happy to be back downtown and in more of a functional setting.
Rick Smith, what do the neighborhoods that were wiped away or destroyed by the flood? I shouldn't say wiped away, because that suggests that the flood swept everything away, and it didn't. But what do they look like now? That are people rebuilding in those same neighborhoods?
Well, there's plenty of rebuilding, but it's all outside of the 100-year floodplain.
Okay.
And much of what was destroyed was in the 100-year floodplain, but the flood really was quite an event and went beyond the 500-year floodplain, even to areas that beyond that. But much of what was in the 100-year floodplain now has been bought out and demolished, and so there'll be quite a strip of greenway, I think is the plan, along the river now as sort of a first line of defense. And Mayor Corbett and the city are still hopeful, I think, that at some point they'll get a nice flood protection system in place here. So a lawn and levee will take the place of where there were a lot of kind of lower middle class housing stock that's now for the most part gone.
Mayor Corbett, the state in April created a funding stream to help cities like Cedar Rapids build and repair the flood protection systems, but the cities have to provide matching funds for that. And I was wondering where the money's coming from after voters turned down a ballot measure. that would have channeled sales tax revenue for that purpose?
Yeah, we're looking at other sources of revenue within the city. What we didn't want to do is try to take money away from police and fire and road construction. We wanted a new source of revenue, and that's why we tried to extend the sales tax. But that didn't happen. The voters turned that down, so we have to honor the results of the election and what the voters have said, and we're looking at alternative sources now to try and draw down that state match.
How important are the flood protection systems? I mean, how important is that?
Well, we think the flood protection system is very important. I mean, one of the reasons that the flood caused so much devastation is we really didn't have any protection, and so we don't want to be defenseless the next time, if there is a next time, that Mother Nature throws us a bad hand. And so that's why we've worked so hard at creating a system that protects, both sides of the river. Now, Rick pointed out earlier that the federal government stepped up, and they certainly did. And much of the buyout money that we've used to move the businesses and homes out of the 100-year flood, I mean, that's the whole purpose of the federal policy, is to move people out of harm's way. And so the next time there is a flood and there isn't flood protection, at least the main area, the 100-year flood, no one's there anymore. But this flood reached well beyond the 500-year flood level. And so that's why that flood protection is needed, to not just protect the east side of the river, but the west side of the river. The Corps of Engineers has already approved east side flood protection, but we want to protect both sides of the river.
Yeah, the city still has requests in front of FEMA, so you're confident. How's the timing been on that? Have they been responding and pretty promptly, or does it take? I guess these are appeals to FEMA now.
Yeah, the FEMA process for some of our appeals has been slow, and we're taking a trip next week to Washington, D.C. to spend some time with FEMA and visit with the White House on some of the critical rebuilding efforts that we still are confronted with. Also, the Corps of Engineers is going through the design work, and ultimately it's Congress that approves the construction money for authorized Corps projects. So that aspect has gone slow just because there's been not a lot of action on a lot of bills in Washington nowadays, and we don't foresee anything happening yet this year. So maybe after the 2012 elections, that sometime next year the Congress will work on their WRDA bill, which is their Water Resource Development Bill, which funds the construction projects for the Corps of Engineers. We hope to see some movement next year on that.
Rick Smith, Joe Blair and I talked about it earlier, the idea of how the flood seemed to creep into the city and also our consciousness. It's certainly true for those of us who live far from Iowa, but what was it like there as a journalist covering it? When did you know to put the pedal to the metal in your coverage, and how did you know when it was going to be a catastrophe?
Well, I think it caught everybody sort of by surprise, actually. I think even if the 13th was the crest of the flood, I would say here on the 11th, we still imagined that it was a manageable flood. And I think the mayor can, I don't know what the storyline is now here for history, mayor, but I think generally the storyline is that there was a deluge of rain the day the river was about to crest. So the city had sort of a flash flood at the same time as it was preparing to handle, say, a 22-foot flood. And they ended up with a 31-foot flood. So I don't know if we were prepared until things really started falling apart, I think, until the bridges downtown were covered with water.
Mm-hmm. Mayor Corbett?
Yeah, I would concur with...
You, of course, weren't mayor at the time, it should be
I
said.
I wasn't, but I would concur with Rick's assessment. I mean, that was some of the earlier warnings of the residents that the flood was coming, and, a lot of people, ignored those warnings, and eventually they exceeded what anyone expected. The fire department had over 420 boat rescues that had to be done during that time a year ago yesterday and a year ago today because of that unexpected rainfall and the ground was already saturated, and we were already expecting a peak, as Rick said, around 21 or 22. So it did catch everyone by surprise from that standpoint.
Go ahead, Rick.
No, Ann, I was just going to say, now that we're 4 years out, I don't know if people are still, how many people in Cedar Rapids are still carrying around this fear of the next flood.
Mm-hmm.
And I think by passage of time, people worry less and less about it, I think. And that might be a little bit of the reason why the city's not been able to pass a local ballot measure here. Might have a little bit to do with it. Even prior to the most recent vote in March, you could talk to people that were flooded who were going to vote against the local measure for flood protection. So I think it is sort of fading from memory a little bit, I think.
At the time, there were apparently some hard feelings with people in Iowa, that they weren't getting the same sort of attention that New Orleans did when Katrina hit and subsequently flooded the city. What do those feelings persist in 4 years hindsight? Do people have a different perspective than they did then? Mayor Corbett?
Yeah, I think people do have a different perspective. I mean, immediately right after the flood, FEMA came in with the personal assistance, and we had donations coming in from around the country. I think what was slow is the promise to buy people out. And so here, the city government is making promises or pledges to buy people's homes and businesses, move them out of harm's way, not knowing where the money was going to come from. And so then people are making decisions then. They're making a decision to buy the home or let their home be bought out and try to find a new place to live. And it was really almost 19 months after that commitment that the first home got bought out. So you could see that frustration level boiling up from the residents, and then that's obviously shared, that frustration is shared from the city council level to the different levels of state and federal government. So I think we felt at that point in time that those resources were slow to come in because of some of the earlier commitments that the city made to residents.
On the other hand, Rick, maybe it's better to come after Katrina and benefit from the lessons learned there?
Well, that's my sense, really. I think FEMA kind of took it on the chin in Katrina. And when Cedar Rapids' problem showed up, like the mayor said, FEMA was here even as the waters were receding.
Mm-hmm.
And these checks that they were handing out to flood victims with, just sort of basic, premised on just basic information, were generally in the range of $25,000, $28,000 to get people, help people to get back on their feet right away. And it was really something, I think, something phenomenal to see here. And, but in terms of buyouts, then I would suggest you're down in kind of some of the paperwork and bureaucracy, and some of that stuff moves a little more closely or a little more slowly.
Rick Smith, thanks so much for your for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, Ann.
Rick Smith, he's a reporter for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and also Cedar Rapids Mayor Ron Corbett. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann, very much.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This segment was produced by Corinne Gleckler. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.